We want the truth, so watch Truth Wanted live Fridays at 7 p.m. Central. Visit tiny.cc/yttw and call into the show at 512-991-9242 or connect to the show online at tiny.cc/calltw. So you think
everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Atheist Experience. I'm your host, Matt Delhoney, joined this week. Paul Ogier, how are you, Paul?
I am excellent. And yeah, I'm so excited to be here. It's so much fun when other people do it that I'm excited.
I'm thrilled to get you on here and have fun. By the way, a couple of quick announcements before we jump right into the first call. I've got this full minute policy thing where, you know, if you're calling in good faith, we want to make sure you get time. And so I've got like a little minute clock that they can put up on that side. That will show you, you know, we'll make sure that we'll just sit here quietly during that minute, unless you just do something absolutely awful where we're, you know, we're kind of, you understand. It's just, we're just trying to make sure we've given people enough time. And also a brief message, because I'm a former military veteran. I know that there are people who are expecting some sort of statement about gun violence and school shootings and the massacre that happened here in Texas. And there's nothing planned for that on the show. If a caller wants to talk about it, then I guess we'll just do it on the fly. But I am putting together some data to do a different show later this week talking about that. So if anybody's like, why aren't they talking about this? There's the actual reason. But the first caller is somebody who's called before and because of communication problems was told to call back, and we put them through first. So welcome, Isaac from Israel. How are you, sir?
Hello, Matt. How are you? And sorry, I didn't catch the other host's name.
It's Paul.
Hey, Paul. Hello. Hey. But yeah, Matt, I'll jump right in. I just want to say one thing first, that I have a beef. I have a beef with you.
Well, you're not the only one. There's like three people waiting with beef.
Well, you ruined Jordan Peterson for me. You know, I back in the day, I used to enjoy him. And you had that that debate. And yeah, I can't, very hard to take him seriously after that. So,
and it got even harder when he did it all on his own, too. But thanks.
Yes. So what I have an argument I want to make, or a proof I want to bring for the authenticity of Judaism. I'll try to get it within 60 seconds. I may fail. Feel free to jump in this.
I'll let you go away. As long as you're doing fine and making a point, we'll let you go over. But yep, start the clock. Prove the authenticity of Judaism.
All right, go ahead. So first of all, I mean, the survival of the Jewish people is obviously remarkable. The fact that we're still around, we still exist as a nation. You know, this has been noticed before. You know, this very famous saying or attributed to Mark Twain, where he lists all the nations of the world, the Egyptians, Babylonians, Persians, Romans, Greeks, etc., and said they all burned out, and the Jews saw them all, beat them all, and now is what he always is. And he asks, what is the secret of his immortality, the Jewish immortality? And Tolstoy, Churchill, Pascal, also similar quotes about the remarkable nature of the Jewish survival, right? And this goes, I mean, this is just in every way. I mean, there's no other parallel in history. I mean, through all the persecution, intermarriage, assimilation, always a minority, always a very small minority, usually a persecuted minority, never gaining real power, but always somehow hanging on and surviving. You know, not sharing a language, not sharing a land, not sharing a culture. We're talking about since diaspora, about 1900, 2000 years ago. And that's all, you know, remarkable 100 years ago, 150 years ago, before the rebirth of the state of Israel. But even more so with the Jews coming back to Israel, reviving a dead language for the first time in history, coming back as a nation from a diaspora, which has also never happened before, 150 countries in the world, the Jewish people conversion, no matter what your opinion is on Israel and the Palestinian conflict and all that, I mean, everybody would acknowledge this is just an absolutely remarkable story. And what I would say, what I would add to that is that for the Jews, as miraculous as this is, and as much as most Jews just celebrate this and are in awe of this, it's not really a surprise, because this is following a plan. This is what we believed all along, right? You know, all the prophecies from throughout Jeremiah, Genesis, of course, Leviticus, all referring to the fact that the Jews will be persecuted. They will be a small nation. They will be a minority. They will be beaten down, but they will never be completely eradicated, and they will eventually return. And while I will freely acknowledge that there's, you know, it's not like, there's nothing there that says, you know, David Ben-Gurion will go and be the first prime minister of Israel in 2,000 years. But, you know, whatever it is that said in these verses was enough to really, to predict exactly, for within the Jewish conscience and within the Jewish belief, predict exactly what happened. And
okay, you had me, and I was willing to let you, you had me, and I was willing to let you keep going.
Yeah, go ahead.
Until you said exactly, after acknowledging that there weren't specific prophecies or anything else. But you did say something interesting, and you said that the survival of the Jews, while remarkable, wasn't a surprise to the Jews. And that's an interesting admission, because if it's not a surprise to the Jews, then that means that there was something about Jewish culture that kept them expecting this survival and persistence. And why wouldn't that belief and expectation, which has been ingrained in Jews, be enough? Where's the link to a God?
Right. So again, you know, like Fyodor Herzl said, right? If you will it, it is no dream, right? So this is, there's definitely, I mean, it could have been self-fulfilling prophecy, I suppose. But, I would say like this, I wouldn't say that this would quite meet the, like, a scientific proof, but what I would
it wouldn't say meet any, it wouldn't meet any proof. I literally just ask you, where's the link to God? And you haven't come close to even remotely addressing that question. Well, so where is the link to a God?
There's verses that you can cite. You know, it says in Genesis.
It doesn't matter what it says in Genesis. It does not matter what it says in Genesis.
Why?
Because that's not evidence of a God. I'm asking you to make the case that shows that the somewhat remarkable, or in your view, if you're Jewish, expected survival of the Jewish people is a significant demonstration of the likelihood of a God.
Well, these chapters are attributed to God, and then they turn
those
out
chapters to attribute those chapters are what contributed to the Jewish belief and culture and traditions it passed on that make this an expected result. But the fact that those passages inspired the Jews to persevere does not mean those passages came from God. Where is the evidence that there's a God involved? I haven't. You said you were going to call to talk about the authenticity of Judaism. I have no problem with the fact that Jewish people exist and Jewish people have beliefs and they have sincere beliefs and that they have a strong cultural tie to where they've even put together the Anti-Defamation League and all these other things. Where does a God come into this?
Well, I mean, if you had made these predictions, you know, 2,000 years ago, right?
What predictions?
In the Roman era, made these predictions, made these same predictions that are in the Bible and that the Jews held on to, right? And that came true. I think you know, people would write some sort of
Hang on, no. If I make a prediction, I make a prediction and it comes true, does that mean I knew what was going to happen?
Well, if you made a prediction that would completely, that has no precedence in history, has no likelihood of being true. Like if we would do a mathematical breakdown of what
No. That is not even in the ballpark of what we're talking about. I asked you, if someone makes a prediction and it comes true, does that mean that they knew what was going to happen?
If somebody makes a prediction, people make predictions all the time and they come true. But if somebody
you are absolutely, and I'm going to turn this over to Paul in a second. You are absolutely refusing to honestly address my question. Of course, people make predictions and they come true. My question was, if someone makes a prediction and it comes true, does that mean they knew it was going to come true at the time of the prediction?
Again, if it's, you know, let's say with insider trading, right?
I am completely done, and I will let Paul decide when to hang up on your ass because I asked a very clear, very specific question, which exposes the problem in your position, and you have repeatedly refused to address it, going off on a tangent each and every time I've said it. So, Paul, do you have a better way to address the authenticity?
Well, so, I mean, one of the things I've been kind of trying to address this with a lot of people who are making Jesus claims, saying that Jesus was like this, had this amazing impact on culture that, you know, is unprecedented. impact on culture. And I think you're making this argument that some of the things that the Jewish people did in history are in some ways unprecedented. And of course, you can, you know, make almost anything unprecedented. This sentence that I just said probably hasn't been specifically said before in history in exactly the same wording that I just gave it. You know, that doesn't mean anything specifically, but I guess you're saying that, you know, the Jewish people achieved, you know, this level. And I think you would agree that, you know, there's always going to be the longest serving culture, right? Like, no matter what, even if the Jewish people disappeared tomorrow, there would now be a next best longest culture, right? Like, that's just definitionally always has to be one, right?
I hear what you're saying. And go back to Matt's point. I do acknowledge what you're saying. I do acknowledge what you're saying. I understand what you're saying.
The question, though, is like, where's that gap? Like, so the second best one, what's the gap between the second best one that's just normal expected and the longest serving one, the second longest serving and then the longest serving? Why is the gap in the middle there divine? Like, what in there are Matt and I are supposed to look at and say, oh, well, yeah, only a god could make the second longest running one be the longest running one?
Right. No, that's a good point. I think that it's two things I would say to that. First of all, it's not one specific thing. It's a confluence, if that's a word, of so many things that each individually on their own would be just remarkable and unprecedented, and then putting them all together. But I think approaching from another way, right? Assuming that you're a Jewish person, right, and you're raised in the Jewish faith from birth, and you're told certain things, and you're told that you're you know, you study the Bible and you study the text, and things are said there and written there, and promises are made there. And then you go ahead and you look at it, and you can look at no other religion or no other culture where
right. But that's just
promises and these,
right?
And these are, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
But that's just uniqueness, right? Like, every culture can find a thing that they do that's unique. Like, if you looked at the Polynesian culture and like how they settled islands, you could say, well, they could point to that and say, well, that's unique, and no one else did that in the same way they did. So everyone has something unique about them that they did. What we're looking for is
unique. I mean, I think it's,
And again, like, this cumulative case, one of the things you listed was like that they would suffer hardships. And it's like, well, which person group on earth didn't suffer some hardships? And is that not the easiest prediction? The only easier prediction is to make is that not everyone's going to believe me, right? like those are some of the easiest predictions.
I think historically a nation either turns into a great nation, like, you know, Chinese or other great nations, or ceases to exist. I don't think there's a nation that just kind of teeters on the edge of
extinction. What about Canada?
For so long.
What about Canada? That's where I live.
They'll get there one day. Yeah, they'll get there. Every election, they say everybody's going to Canada. So,
but I guess I just don't. Yeah, I mean, I think what's this divine? What's the gap? What's divine in this gap? If you can't give me that, then I think we're probably done. Or do you kind of acknowledge that these are all things that can be explained naturally, and you're just really impressed by them?
I don't have naturally, but it would have to go to a very, 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 very extreme place to explain them naturally, right? Meaning mathematically, I don't know exactly what it would fall into, but it would be into some tiny fraction of a percent that this could actually happen.
Okay, but things like that happen all the time. And to Matt's point earlier, I mean, I think when Israel is restored as a nation, there were Christians around the globe, including me at the time when I was a Christian, who were cheering on. You know, I wasn't born in 67, but like my parents and like everyone were all doing everything they could to restore this Jewish nation, because that was something that was supposed to happen to bring the end times, right? So like it becomes less unlikely when so many people are working for it.
So I'm going to jump back in.
Yep.
Because here's a fallacious argument. Getting a perfect bridge hand is unlikely unless someone cheats. This person just got a perfect bridge hand, therefore I'm justified in believing that the dealer cheated. Do you see what the fallacy is there?
Right.
Okay. I can change everything about that argument and say...
I don't know bridge. I don't know how bridge works. So
Bridge means you have all 13 cards of the same suit. It's astronomically unlikely, but it has in fact happened. We have records of it actually happening in tournaments. So the fact that it can happen, whether someone cheats or not, means that if you get a perfect bridge hand, you don't have enough evidence to conclude whether or not somebody cheated. Similarly, you can't say it is unlikely that the Jewish nation would have survived survived unless there is a God. The Jewish nation survived, therefore I'm justified in believing a God exists. It is exactly the same argument, structure. The only thing that has changed is the content. This is why when we're studying logic, we talk about propositions and we evaluate the structure of arguments. That structure is part of the problem. And so your entire argument breaks down to the survival of the Jewish people is unlikely unless there's a God, and the Jewish people survived, therefore I'm justified in believing that there's a God. That is absolutely, unequivocally, a fallacy. And when you also consider that, you know, human beings have been on the planet for 300,000 years or so, and Jews have been on the planet for about 5,000 years, and in the last, all of this has only happened in the, you know, the last 100 or so years, 200 years, where Jews and non-Jews were working together to reestablish a Jewish state, what the fuck did a God do? If people did this, what did a God do?
Well, you know, again, in the analogy of the bridge hand, it would be like if you were born into this religion that told you that you would get perfect bridge hands on a constant basis, and that's a proof of the religion, and then you're constantly getting perfect bridge hands, you would have no reason to leave this religion, right? You would say, wow, this is, I mean, and then you're looking around at all other belief systems and all other cultures, and none of them add up to that.
This is ridiculous, and I'll tell you, This is ridiculous, and I'll tell you why. According to the book that you're pointing to, where you want to get these prophecies from, God also flooded the entire planet except for a drunk and his family. God also, when his chosen people were enslaved, laid out plagues like the world had never seen in an incredible, majestic, magical display in order to save his chosen people. What the fuck has he done lately? Why on earth would you give credit for the trials and troubles and reformation of a Jewish culture? Where's the slaughter of the firstborn for this century? Where's any evidence that there's any God anywhere? I would say that using Occam's razor, the fact that people believe something and work to enact and save their group is far more impressive as a human achievement, as a God achievement, where he's hiding in the shadows and doing absolutely nothing except maybe inspiring some people to work for something. What happened to this God that was the miracle worker that would travel as a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day and feed people manna from heaven in order to protect his chosen people? Why on earth would you think that the survival of the Jewish people is conditioned on a God that has been absent since we've been able to investigate the claims?
Yeah, I mean, I think what a lot of people, what some rabbis would say, is that a lot of it's metaphorical. Now, again, then you could, I guess, argue to that and say, well, then what's to say that the claims that I'm bringing are not metaphorical? And that's certainly an interesting point.
Yeah, I'm not interested in metaphors.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah. If you want to make a case for a God, the word metaphor better not enter into it at all. And the survival of the Jewish people, while I suppose is mildly remarkable, I don't find it that remarkable when they believed. By the way, you're talking about, you know, the Jews in Israel, which is where you are, I'm assuming correctly, right?
Aren't
they like 50% secular?
Yeah, at least. I think.
Wouldn't God have known that the Jews that he was creating, you know, that he was working in the shadows, not doing anything public, but working in the shadows to inspire them, wouldn't he have known that 50% of them were going to stop believing?
Well, I mean, you know, even the times of the Bible, there was you know, idolatry.
What the hell does it? That's not an answer to my question. Every time I ask a question that is designed to make a point, you deflect and go off on a tangent that's completely irrelevant. Wouldn't a God, now I don't care. I don't even care what your answer is. None of this rises to the level of believing that a God exists. If you want to sit around and be impressed that the Jews have survived and therefore conclude that there's a God protecting them, that's your problem.
But I just want to say one last thing, that this is, and maybe I didn't make this argument eloquently, but there are many Jewish thinkers that are otherwise, you know, like I'm talking about, you know, people with PhDs and philosophers and people and who are not, you know, impressed by like gimmicky beliefs of God. And this is like, you know, this is their go-to.
Yes. Thank you for that. Absolutely garbage, fallacious. No. That is a garbage, fallacious appeal at the end of this. That, well, you know, I don't know what to say, but there's a whole bunch of people with degrees and shut up. There's a whole bunch of people with I'm saying shut up. To say that there's a whole bunch of people with degrees who find this rather impressive is a dishonest attempt to redeem your point after it's been rebutted. Have one of them call. Maybe they can make the case.
Right. That's not the point I was trying to make, but fair enough.
Thanks. That's the way it comes off. When you present your case and we point out what our problems are, and when we point out what the problems are, and your primary response after deflecting away from the points is to say, well, maybe I didn't do a good job. There's a bunch of people with PhDs who believe this stuff, and maybe, you know, okay, cool. Get one of them to call.
you have maybe have not heard this argument before, but what I'm saying is if this is an atheist show that's intended to convince people of, you know, that there is no God, if that's what
That's not the thing. You know, it's definitely... Here we go, Isaac. At no point in the history of this show have any of us said that our purpose is to convince people that there is no God. That is a complete shifting of the burden of proof. We have no proof. Don't say right and jump in as if you knew that all along. You just completely got the burden of proof backwards and misrepresented the purpose of the show. You are now backed into a corner and you are flailing around like a dragon that has just had its wings clipped. Can you just say, hey, I'll think about this some more, and maybe when I come up with something better, I'll call back? Because what you presented today is not a reasonable argument. It is not a sound argument in the slightest. I pointed out the fallacies in, and you agreed with them. What else could we possibly do with that?
Well, again, thanks for having me on the show, and it's been a pleasure, believe it or not.
Sure. I enjoyed it, too.
Thanks, Isaac. Think about this some more.
It's one of those things where I don't think Isaac's stupid. No. I don't think he's being intentionally dishonest. I think that he's looking around at what a lot of people have said. And one of the interesting things to me, I'm getting ready to do a video on time and how long, you know, we've been here and how absent God has been for the right. most of it. But it's this, I just think it's absolutely remarkable that the Jewish people survived, therefore there's a God, is fundamentally identical to, I just think it's absolutely remarkable the diversity of life, therefore right. a God.
Though with his example, I do like to, you know, show that there's something is second most persecuted and second most long suffering. Like, is that almost divine? Like, it's
yeah,
it's just not. There's a gap there that God doesn't fill.
Because if this was the argument, like this is the primary argument, this is the best argument that somebody's come up with for Judaism, then the point you made that when Jews become the second most impressive surviving identity, what argument are they going to use then?
Right.
You have the second best God?
Exactly right.
Or they have the same God, but he actually loved these other people more, even though you used to be the chosen, but you fucked up, and now 50% of you are secular, so he's going to go and save the Muslims. Good job.
Exactly.
I tell you what, thank you everybody for tuning in. We are live, and we just did like a big long first call, so I've got some announcements to get out of the way. The first is, if you are watching us in chat, there's a donation link down below. It's not, we previously did this for the Secular Student Alliance at SSA in past weeks. This week we are back to just being greedy little give us your money so that we can continue to produce content like this. 100% of your donations from that link go directly to the Atheist Community of Austin. They don't pass go. They don't get held over at Google and YouTube so they can take a cut. None of that. But it's not the only way that you can contribute, and not all of your contributions need to be financial, although it does help. There is merchandise that you can actually buy. The link will be up here at tiny.cc/merchaca if you're interested in having cool stuff. And this month's shirt is Theist, You Need to Bring Your A Game, which I kind of like that. A game and a theist and a something. I don't know. It's a t-shirt, which is cool. But in addition, you can also become a member on the YouTube channel for like 99 cents a month or something like that. Not only do you get special icons, but it also puts you in a position where if we are forced to put the chat in slow mode, you get out of slow mode, which means, you know, you're like the trusted people who aren't going to spam and troll us. Appreciate that. And you can go to patreon.com/theatheistexperience to contribute that way. If you want to participate in discussions, there are unofficial forums, the Atheist Experience fan group, which will appear on the screen as I'm saying it, because it always does. These guys are awesome. tiny.cc/FBAXP. There's also the Atheist Experience private fan group, which is at /FBAXPPR for private. And if you want to have discussions live with people, maybe even in a voice capacity, there's the unofficial ACA Discord. And after the show's over together today, I think Paul's going to be on there, right?
Yeah, I will be there.
Paul will be there hanging out. I won't be there today, but I'll be there another day. And there's plenty of great people. I don't need to be there. But if you have feedback, questions, concerns, criticisms, you can email tv@atheist-community.org. That goes to myself and all the people behind the scenes. Are we ready for another call?
I'm ready.
I'm going to apologize in advance. I'm going to take this call, and he's calling specifically for me.
Fine. I got coffee.
And then we'll dig on other things. So, Clarence, welcome to the show, kind of. We had a brief discussion before the show started where Clarence called me a narcissistic sociopath and then a coward. But he's got this point about the logical absolutes, which aren't absolutes, they're misnamed. And I'm happy to address it. So what's your point here, Clarence? Welcome.
Thank you. Kind of. You have often made the point that one can either has to be convinced or unconvinced of the existence of a God. And the point I'd like to make is just very simple. In order to be convinced or unconvinced, the word convinced implies that you have considered the issue and are either convinced or unconvinced. However, it is possible for people to exist, and people have existed, and I can give several examples. People exist who are totally unfamiliar with the concept of a God. And someone who is totally unfamiliar and has never even been exposed to the concept of a God is neither convinced or unconvinced.
That's not true. That's not true.
The word unconvinced.
No, we're pausing right here. You seem to be confused and equating the notion of not being convinced with being disconvinced or something. All I'm saying is that for any proposition, you are either convinced of that proposition or you are not convinced. This is a/not a scenario, and those are the only options. And so if someone says, are you convinced of Fergalburgle, and you've never heard Fergalburgle, you don't know what a proposition is, then you cannot possibly be convinced of it. So you are still in the I know you're saying that, Clarence, but you're wrong. Would you stop talking did you think we were going to agree, Clarence?
Don't know. I thought maybe you would consider my argument and agree with it.
I did consider it, and I'm explaining to you why it's wrong. Would you like me to do that? Or do you want to just sit here and be confident in yourself without being rebutted?
I would be glad to listen to it. Go ahead.
Good. Then shut the fuck up. Okay. I have written down on my table here a proposition. You have no idea what that proposition is, do you? That was a question. Are you going to answer the question?
I have no idea what that proposition is.
Okay. Are you convinced that my proposition is true?
I am neither convinced or unconvinced
That's not what I asked, you dishonest fuck. I said, are you in fact convinced that my proposition is true? That's a yes or no question.
I am neither convinced or unconvinced.
Clarence, this is a yes or no question. I didn't say, are you unconvinced? I said, are you convinced? And so if I say, are you convinced? And you say, I'm neither convinced, then your answer to my question is no, you are not convinced, correct?
Incorrect. I am neither convinced or unconvinced.
You are flat wrong, and I will explain this to people who are going to be honest and discuss it.
Clarence, I need you to stop. I need you to not use the word unconvinced again during this call, because that's the problem. You're using this word unconvinced. What I need you to only use the phrase non-convinced, okay? Because the phrase unconvinced is where you're going completely off track. So just if you can not use that for the rest of the call and just say non-convinced, all right?
I have a statement written down. Do you believe that that statement is true? Are you in fact convinced that this statement is true right now?
I don't know, because I don't know the statement.
No, you do know that you are not convinced.
No, the word convinced implies that I am familiar with the statement and that I've considered
I'm muting you. Yes, in order to become convinced, you have to be familiar with the statement. And then the weight of the evidence in favor of that proposition has convinced you. But until you've been presented with the proposition, you are not convinced. And until you've been presented with sufficient evidence, you are also not convinced. Not being convinced of a proposition does not mean that you are convinced the proposition is false. So let's see if we can agree on that. Would you agree that if person A is not convinced that the proposition is true, that does not mean that person A is convinced it's false?
Say that again.
Yeah, if you were listening, I wouldn't have to. Here we go. Here, let me mute you again. Paul. I won't even use abstractions.
Okay.
Paul is not convinced that I have $1 million in the bank. Does that mean that Paul is convinced that I do not have $1 million in the bank? That's the question.
Has Paul been presented with the claim that you have?
Goodbye, Clarence. I'm sorry that you can't be honest in this discussion. That was a simple, straightforward question. Goodbye, sir. You can think I'm a sociopathic narcissist all you want. You can think that I'm a coward. I'm pretty decent at explaining complicated topics in a simple way, but sometimes someone like you comes along and it makes it impossible. This is a really simple question, and everybody else watching is able to answer it.
Right.
Paul says that he is not convinced that I have $1 million, that does not mean that Paul is in fact convinced that I do not have $1 million. It's like just saying, if I'm not convinced that you're innocent, that does not mean that I'm convinced you're guilty. I'm sorry that your confusion about this is so deep, but identity, non-contradiction, and excluded middle are the presuppositional foundations of logic. They don't go away just because you haven't been presented with an idea. Meanwhile, your absurd point about the fact that there are people out there who've never been presented with a God concept is laughable. No, it's true. I mean, it's absolutely true that there are people out there, there's babies born every minute that haven't been presented with a God concept yet. But to suggest that this somehow undermines logic shows the depths that you're willing to go to not have to understand the difference between if I say, hey, we know for a fact that the number of blades of grass on the planet is either even or odd. And if Paul is not convinced that it's even, that does not mean that Paul is convinced it's odd. This is the basic, most simple foundations of logic. Identity, non-contradiction, excluded middle. They apply to every proposition that there ever has been, ever could be, ever will be.
I was trying to force him down the line of dichotomy, but he did not want to be in a dichotomy.
Nope. Every time you do the, I'm neither convinced nor unconvinced. Mm-hmm. Every time you say that, just look at it. I'm neither convinced. That means I am not convinced.
Yep.
And so your statement is self-contradictory. I'm neither convinced nor not convinced. Yes, you are. You're just really, really, really confused.
All right.
While that wasn't a atheist versus theist debate, there is an atheist versus theist debate group on Facebook if you want to go there and have them. And somebody could come in and say, you know what? Hey, let's have that discussion about logical identity and non-contradiction. And is it possible for me to be both convinced and not convinced, or to be neither convinced nor not convinced? You could do that kind of stuff there. Although don't tell them I told you to do that, because while it's, you know, an official group, I don't want them to be mad at me for sending, you know, people there to argue really basic things. In addition to this program, the ACA also sponsors a good many other shows. You might have seen Talk Heathen earlier today. I heard good things. And in between Talk Heathen and Atheist Experience, there's also the nonprofits, the supposed flagship of the atheist community of Austin, which airs between those with new hosts and new segments. And I know they have some upcoming segments, including I think next week's is supposed to have a segment on gun violence in America. I don't know the details because I wasn't on that show. I just heard about it today. So I'm interested in tuning in to find out what's going on. And if you've missed shows, you can also go to tiny.cc/AEN podcasts to get audio versions of all the content that we produce from all the different shows: Truth Wanted, Secular Sexuality, Talk Heathen, Atheist Experience, Nonprofits, etc. Anything that we're actively producing right now, you're going to get live. You're going to get not live. But you're going to get audio podcasts there. And the reason is that there's a lot of people working behind the scenes here to make this show happen. We worked on audio issues. We worked on video issues. There are people, lovely people, doing moderation, call screening, taking notes, putting down timestamps so that we can have appropriate clips here. Let's put the crew up on the screen here. We can see, look, woo-hoo. That's not those five people that you see are not the only people who are actively working behind the scenes, even at this moment, because there's other people over in chat who are doing their best right now. And we greatly love and appreciate all of them. I got two new cats. I had a week off from the show. They're the only two cats I have now. I mean, I went from zero cats to two.
Okay.
I got a little ill, so I had to cancel my Wednesday night show and other stuff. So I have missed a good deal of what's gone on in the ACA this week. And that's why we put this clip together.
Recognize aspects that you might otherwise be completely unfamiliar with. Like, how many people in the last 20 minutes learned the word futenaria and suddenly discovered that, goodness, maybe I need to open up another tab.
Because we grew up in evangelicalism, we want to just tell everyone now, like, I'm an atheist, because we were used to having beliefs where all we did was proclaim our beliefs and we were supposed to preach and proselytize. And so it's hard to deconstruct and lose that mentality of having to share.
I don't know how common sharing bodily fluids was in any of those types of rituals. There was some strange stuff, but nowadays this type of stuff is generally confined to the realm of you know, some extreme sexual fetishes.
Or Sunday mass.
It's like saying the King of the United States has a beard. Well, until you show me that there's a King of the United States, the proposition's false. But you go, oh, well, the King of the United States doesn't have a beard. That proposition's also false. Wait a second. He either has a beard or he doesn't have a beard. How can they both be false? Well, they're both false because there's no King of the United States.
How old do you think our solar system is?
Not more than tens of thousands of years. I mean,
they
have an exact date.
Okay, well, you're wrong about that then.
own. And we're back. We're going to move on, take some more callers here. I've got Kevin in New York has a question. So I don't know if you're up on this, Paul, but I'm not. So welcome, Kevin. How can we help?
Hey, hey, you guys. Thanks for taking my call. I don't have a question. I have a claim to present to you.
Awesome.
It's something that I think that if you guys will even take some of this information and investigate for yourselves, it'll finally be something that will convince you going towards the existence of God. But,
great.
My claim was...
Hang on 1 second, Kevin. I want to make sure I understand this, and then okay. I'll give you time to go. You're saying you have a claim that you think will help us find the truth that a God exists, right?
Yes.
Okay. Paul, did you have anything else, or we're going to...
No, I'm just excited.
Cool. So, well, start the clock, and Kevin, the floor is yours, sir.
The claim was that there is science within the Book of Enoch. To really pinpoint where this claim is that the Book of Enoch is describing what we now know as supermassive black holes. Enoch viewed a supermassive black hole, and he's describing it in three different verses within the book. The surprising thing is that as someone who's read the book over many times, I never knew that Enoch was talking about a supermassive black hole until the context was revealed to me. It's not very important, but it was by an author who was once atheist and referred to Christianity. There's two different directions I can go with this. I can go into what we know scientifically about supermassive black holes, or I can go right into the verses that are talking about exactly that. But it also has to be kept in mind that Enoch is describing these things within his ability to do so. So it may not sound scientific right off the bat.
So it sounds to me like there exists some text that can be interpreted as if Enoch is describing supermassive black hole. And nobody was aware of this before we knew about supermassive black holes. And you weren't aware about it until somebody said, hey, what he's describing is a supermassive black hole. But that doesn't mean that there's science in the Bible. And even if it was, how does this demonstrate that a God exists? Let's assume that Enoch, in his limited wisdom, and by the way, this is not a canonical book.
No.
Which is weird. But let's assume that Enoch described to the best of his ability to understand things, a supermassive black hole. How do you show that this is knowledge that came from God? And why couldn't God describe it in such a way that it actually led us to a discovery and understanding of supermassive black holes rather than only discovering it after we already knew what it was?
That's a lot to unpack there. Where to start? Well, I mean, it really does have a little bit to do with where the origins of where this book came from. I believe it's a lot more ancient than this, but you're right that it's not a canonical book, but it was one of many that were, I guess you could say, lost for a while and then wasn't rediscovered until 1773 within the orthodoxy of
It seems odd that if this is sufficient to prove that a God exists, that God didn't do anything to protect this book and maintain it as part of canon if it was going to teach us something about science. But the question I asked is, let's assume, I don't need to see exactly what Enoch says, because you've already said that it's in limited language, and so it might be clear. So are we in agreement that it is a matter of interpretation that he is describing a supermassive black hole and not just a matter of fact?
Not at all, because you may not like this answer, but I believe that it was written in a way to keep it a mystery until a time that we could then look back and understand it. You know, because I realize the implications of, if I'm correct about this, it's really an amazing thing, because...
No, it's not.
I realize what it takes to...
You're basically setting up a scenario where when people say, how do we know that this is what you say it is? Your response is, you think it was written in a way to keep it a mystery. So basically, you think God revealed something to Enoch and then hid it only to reveal it later, right?
Yes.
Then even if that God exists, he's completely useless and irrelevant to me. But also, you don't have any way to show that he exists.
Well, just for a moment, man. What I was saying, I mean, I realize the implications behind all this, because I mean, I know what it takes to say, you know, going back to my claim, I realize what it takes to even detect something like a supermassive black hole. Now, once a person knows that, you know, what is it about the supermassive black hole that he's describing? It's the, one second. It's, for one thing, we know scientifically that black holes, not necessarily supermassive ones, are able to capture the gravity of nearby orbiting suns and actually sort of tear them apart little by little. And so using that as a backdrop of what we have detected scientifically, we can then look at the Enoch verses and come to that conclusion that he's talking about exactly that.
So
did you say exactly that? Sorry, Paul.
Go ahead. No, you go for it, man.
You just said that, right? He's describing exactly. So it's clear to anybody who understands this that, in fact, Enoch is describing a supermassive black hole. And okay, go ahead, Paul.
All I was going to say was, so there's a lot of things in the Bible that we now retroactively look. So, for example,
I muted you. There's some background noise, but Paul continue.
There's in the Old Testament, there's a lot of phrases where people talk about God stretching the heavens, for example. And then in more recent days, since Big Bang Theory kind of became adopted and accepted even by the most ardent Christian, that, you know, they now look back and say, oh, stretching the heavens always meant space expanding. Whereas, you know, in the context of the verses, it sure doesn't need to say that. Now, one can, of course, say, sure, I want to interpret this as a multi-layered thing. But what is the marker that we can take to say, you know what, this is not just me interpreting this in hindsight ad hoc as something scientific versus something that was definitely intended to be scientific? So, for example, if other books made scientific claims, like say the Quran made some claims and those later turned out could be interpreted in light of science, how do we tell the difference between category A, where it's just something being reinterpreted, and category B, where it was a divine prophecy? What's the marker? How do I know?
I'm glad you said that, because this is going to be an example of exactly what I was just talking about, because and how we can use science as a backdrop to understand this. Now, to be more specific, a scientific data that came out as an observer.
No, I don't want to hear about black holes at all. I don't care about black holes that much. What I want to hear is how you tell the difference between something that was intended to be science and something that was just that we're retroactively
Be clear. I definitely want Paul to get his answer, and it's good, but there's no science here in the Book of Enoch. The fact that somebody's describing something doesn't mean they're doing science. There's no scientific methods. There's no nothing. But if we describe something, and you say that the description in these three verses, which I'm assuming are 18:11, 21:3, and 108:4, that in those three verses he's describing a black hole, and Paul's saying, how do you tell when someone is describing something in the Bible that is metaphorical or symbolic or a vision that is not a black hole but might be interpreted as one versus a vision of a black hole? That's what he's asking. So we don't need any information of black holes. We need information about how you can tell that the Book of Enoch is accurately describing a black hole versus describing a deep abyss with columns.
Right.
You can tell because the setting was placed. I already told you that Enoch was describing the best that he could, but the setting was placed, which is something that I didn't discover right away.
I don't know what you mean. We're asking for a mechanism. What do you mean the setting was placed?
The setting meaning the location, to be more specific, because again, with Enoch explaining this the best he could, had also said somewhere.
Right, but the Enuma Elish, like
this is a place beyond the great earth where the heavens come together.
I'm not concerned about the specifics. I'm concerned about your epistemology right now. So, for example, there are Babylonian, Mesopotamian creation myths that exist that if you squint real hard, some of it sounds like it may accurately line up with new scientific discoveries.
I must say there's Quran has a description of a fetus.
Right.
It doesn't.
So, well, I mean, so does, I guess you know, I'm super interested in your epistemology. Like, let's not talk about the details about Enoch anymore.
Yeah.
How can I, a non-believer in all this stuff, tell the difference between what was intended to be telling me something true about the natural world that wouldn't be discovered for thousands of years and something that just happens to sound like it? How can I tell without referencing Enoch at all?
Just further investigation of it, because to make it seem like I'm not cherry picking, which I know it does seem like it does come off that way. It comes from a background of considering a whole bunch of other things. Like, for example, I do believe that in such a way that this book was protected because because it was lost for a while. And
we're done, Kevin, and I'm gonna we're done. Kevin, and I'm gonna explain why. Paul just asked you for a method and you rambled for a minute and then you said you were going to give the method. You made a statement that was like it. And the response right after that was like, for example, and then you went on to talk about what you think about the book. It doesn't seem that you have. So here's the thing. First of all, you're calling about a book that's not canonical, that's not considered, you know, part of the canon at all. You suspect that it was hidden, but the three verses, am I correct that it's 18:11, 21:3 and 108:4?
Yes, that's right.
Sure. So verse 18:11 says, "And I saw a deep abyss with columns of heavenly fire, and among them I saw columns of fire fall, which were beyond measure, alike toward the height and toward the depth." That doesn't describe a supermassive black hole. And I mean, even if you turn your head sideways and squint and make it blurry, that still doesn't get you to a black hole. 21:3 says, "And there I saw seven stars of the heaven bound together in it, like great mountains and burning with fire." Now that's cool, except that that doesn't place it as necessarily outside of the earth. You can see the stars from there. But why seven stars? This is parable language. This is the language where we're going to put a number in, and it's always going to be 7 or 6 or 13 or 12, or, you know, the ones that are important, and 40. And then 108:4 says, "And I saw there something like an invisible cloud, for by reason of its depth, I could not look over. And I saw a flame of fire blazing brightly, and things like shining mountains circling and sweeping to and fro." That's really cool language, but there's no reason to think that Enoch was actually describing a black hole. There's no reason to think that Enoch would have known he was describing a black hole. And if in fact he understood or was given the understanding of a supermassive black hole by God, then God failed to give him decent language. So why would God go to all the trouble to hide a book that doesn't achieve the goal that you think it achieves? Why would God fail to give Enoch a reason? Like, if you're going to hide a book so that in a couple thousand years, it turns out that this is clear proof of you, why wouldn't Enoch have written, "God is going to hide these words and they will be discovered and people will understand that in the depths of the expansive space are massive, you know, blah, blah, blah," and then go on to describe something that's actually like a black hole. But the other reason that we're done is because at the very beginning of this, I said that let's assume that Enoch has actually described a supermassive black hole. How? So I'm going to grant you everything here, Kevin. I'm no more the other questions. I'm just going to say, for the sake of this argument, let's assume that Enoch in his book said, we'll do both parts. I have been given a vision by God of a supermassive black hole, and God is, and here's the description, and God's going to hide these words for 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years, whatever it is. Even if the book of Enoch said that, how would that prove that there was in fact a God?
It would prove that there's a God because, I mean, look what it took for us to for us to discover a supermassive black hole. We haven't even known the existence of a black hole for more than, I want to say, 150 years. It would prove that Enoch is a prophet.
It wouldn't prove any of these things. None of this is proved by pointing to a book that looks like it knew something, because how did you rule out time travel?
And how I even came to the conclusion that these are black holes that he's describing?
No. Wow. How did you get that from the question I just asked? I asked you, how did you rule out time travel?
Well, it's a vision. So,
Wow. Okay. How did you rule out someone traveling back in time and writing a book in the context of a vision about the future? How did you rule out time travel?
There's no time travel needed in this.
No, that's not what I asked, Kevin. How did you conclude that God is a better explanation for how Enoch could have known this than that time travel is a better explanation for how Enoch could have known this? Meanwhile, we haven't even shown Enoch knew anything, but how did you rule out time travel?
I don't know.
Yeah, right. You don't know.
Or that Enoch had the technology before, like this was pre, sorry, Paul. I was going to say this is pre-flood, right? Enoch was Noah's father, if I remember correctly. So maybe they actually had the same technology we had back, you know, before the flood destroyed it all. And that they literally had.
I'm not saying that.
How did you rule that out?
I'm not saying that.
I love that now you're saying, I'm not saying that there's no proof of that. There's no proof of any of this. That's the point. You have a model about the Book of Enoch that could lead to at least one of two different explanations, that Enoch received a prophecy from a god, or that Enoch received a prophecy from a time traveler, or that Enoch himself was a time traveler, or that someone else was a time traveler and actually conveyed this information and it just got labeled as Enoch, or that none of this shit actually happened. Show which one of those five, and there's probably dozens more, is most likely, and why you think that God of those five is most likely.
I don't know where to start with all that.
Well, I tell you what, we'll drop it here. We'll go on and take some other calls. You figure out where to start and then call us back to show why a non-canonical book that isn't part of any of the relevant religions has a passage in it that in hindsight, someone can say looks a little bit like it might be describing a supermassive black hole. And therefore, God is the most plausible explanation for that. Work on it. Call us back.
It's because of the implications behind.
I said work on it and call it back. Call us back. Thanks.
The trouble, of course, it would have been nice if Enoch would have done something more relevant that more people would have known about, that, you know, like, so if Enoch could have told us about the plan of salvation written before.
Uh-oh, Paul froze up. Oh, there he is. You're back.
Oh, shoot. I got lost. All I was saying was that the plan of salvation is a much more important thing for God to reveal to people than super black holes. Maybe Enoch could have, you know, before Noah's flood, could have revealed the plan of salvation, and we could have seen that as the evidence. That
might be. We partially lost Paul for a second. I'm going to go on to another call.
I'm going to refresh just so that, so crew, you can solo Matt for a sec.
Yeah. Jonathan is calling from Colorado. Pronouns are he, him. Welcome, Jonathan. You had a question about atheists doing community work. So how are you?
Hey, Matt. How you doing?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
You look great, man.
Well, thanks. Although that's not relevant, but yeah, I'm surviving. But you had a question about atheist community.
I'm just saying, your old videos, man, you really made a lot of improvement, is all I'm saying, physically speaking.
All I did was have a heart attack, an open heart surgery, and get older, but thanks. So let's talk about the things that are relevant to the show.
Okay. The atheist experience, and, well, the organization in, what is it, Austin, Texas?
Yes, Atheist Community of Austin.
Okay, and you've been doing community reach out kind of stuff, right? I mean, you've been helping people with your resources who are in need.
Yeah, it's not so charitable work is not a primary function of the ACA, but there are a number of other atheist organizations like Atheists Helping the Homeless and Humanists at Work and Secular Student Alliances and stuff that we work with, you know, Recovering from Religion and others. So we're all doing good work in different ways. But if you're talking about like efforts to feed the homeless, we work with other organizations because that's not specifically within our charter. But there's plenty of atheists involved. Yeah.
Well, I think that's great.
Me too.
I'm just questioning, like, what's the motivation is what my question is.
To help people and make the world a better place. The notion that...
But why?
Don't you think that having a better world where people are starving less is a good thing?
Yes, I do think that.
So why wouldn't you want to work towards a good thing?
Well, because I can only accumulate so much for myself. And okay, I'm a loner, right? But if I got a wife and kids and everything, those resources could go to myself and my direct family. And I was just questioning, well, the motivation part. And of course, you're atheist, okay? I know that. But I'm just saying, on your part, well, what's the motivation?
Because I already told you, it makes the world a better place. So there's a reason for plenty of people to help out others. And that is, at some point, I may be in need. And so if I help create a society that helps those in need, I'm ultimately protecting myself. It's like engaging in a little bit of insurance. If you make the world a better place, and you work together with people who are also convinced that we'd like to see the world a better place, then if you fall on hard times, you have people to potentially reach out to. We are stuck on this planet and we have to work cooperatively. We know from game theory that cooperation is the best course of action, that this is the one that benefits all of us. And so that person who is homeless right now, who receives some socks and food and, you know, maybe some help, could be the person who saves my life later or who comes up with a cure for cancer. But even if they never do anything else, the notion that we worked towards a goal of a better planet produces a better planet. If the more people who are busy working towards good, then the better options we have to counteract those things that are not good. I don't know why this is even confusing to people. I'm more baffled by people who amass incredible wealth more than they ever, like I've watched a good chunk of the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, and one suing one for $50 million and one suing one for $100 million. Those are numbers that make no sense to me, but I appreciate the fact that they earned that. Johnny Depp has made probably billions and earned billions for others over the years. Cool. I'm not begrudging anybody with loads of money, but if I had $7 million and said that I would donate to charity, I would have donated it to charity because you should do what you say you do, and it works to make the world better. I don't need 4 houses, a private island. I don't need that, you know, I do okay. I'm broke as often as I've ever been, but the question is, I don't mean to be a dick or anything, Jonathan, but the question is genuinely confusing to me because it seems like you think the only reason
you can be a dick.
Hang on. Then let me finish talking. It seems like you're claiming or concerned that the only reason anyone could do good for someone else is if there's a God to command it, or even if they believe
okay,
there's
that's
a God.
True.
Yeah. And so
from my side. Okay.
So you think the only reason to do good things is because you believe in a God?
Well, you want the truth, Matt?
Yeah, always.
Yeah. Okay. Look, man, if there is no moral
then I hope. Yeah, no. This is people. No, Jonathan, this isn't about whether or not there's a moral law. If you are only willing to do good because you believe in a God, then I hope you continue to believe in a God and do good, because it's like saying, are you suggesting that the only reason not to kill people is because there's a God?
Look, people are after living their lives. There's
that's not what I asked.
Out there growing up.
That's not what I asked. That's not what I asked, Jonathan. Do you think the only reason to not kill other people is because there's a God?
Well, I guess not.
Yeah. What reason? Let's assume for a second you stopped believing in a God. What reason would you have to not kill people?
No reason.
So you just said that.
Reversed your position. Profit in it. There's no money in it.
So your primary goal then is money.
Yes, I did reverse my position.
So now you're saying your primary goal is money. Well, then I'm really sad, but you don't get to lecture me or anybody else about morality, because if your primary goal is money,
No.
If your primary goal is money, not only are you grossly immoral, but you're not following the tenets of Christianity, where Jesus specifically tells you to sell all your belongings and give the money to the poor.
I agree.
Yeah. So who's the hypocrite here? The atheist who does good because good needs to be done and because good benefits us all? Or the Christian who says, if there wasn't a God and there's no profit in it, fuck everybody else, I should be able to kill him. That's disgusting, Jonathan. You need to go off and think about this. I've answered your question as far and as best as I'm going to. Please reevaluate your supposed moral compass, because it is askew, I promise you. Are you back, Paul? Oh, I can't hear you at all. Well, while Paul's getting his audio up.
Let me try that now.
You're back. You're back. I hear you. And we're gonna move on from people whose moral compass is a little askew to someone who is asking for some help. Sheila in Kentucky, thanks so much for your patience. I meant to take your call earlier, but welcome to the show.
Hi, Matt and Paul. Hey. I'm in ICU right now. My husband is, he had open heart surgery and he's had complications and he's been here about 8 days. Wow. And I'm really at a point where I need comfort and I need support. I'm trying to keep myself positive and to keep myself from sinking into despair. And I'm doing a pretty good job overall.
Yeah.
But, you know, yesterday, one of my relatives, who is a retired nurse, she told me that, you know you don't want to hear this, but you need to pray and to call out to God, because non-believers, which my husband and I are both atheists, non-believers don't recover as quickly in her experience. So she's implying that if I don't pray and if I don't call out to God, that somehow I'm to blame for my husband's decline
And if he doesn't recover, it's my fault. And I'm so fucking pissed because she's preying on my vulnerability and she's trying to bring me back into the fold when I'm at this weak point and I'm never, ever going back there. It's taken me decades to break away from the brainwashing. And I just wanted to call just to say how fucking angry I am. And I just need support. And this is what I get.
Yeah, you should be angry. The one thing you can take comfort in is that this retired nurse is actually retired, which means she's not spreading this bullshit to other patients at the hospital and is instead, you know, plaguing you. There are studies, and so she's not completely nuts. There are studies, like the Templeton Foundation did studies on intercessory prayer, and I believe that was specifically with heart patients. And if you care to actually engage with her, you could point out that in that study from the Templeton Foundation that they found that if patients knew they were being prayed for, they did worse. And that there was no statistical significance between the prayers, the intercessory prayers, who they came from or who they were directed towards. The in-group and the out-group did functionally the same. And the only group that did worse were the people who knew they were being prayed for. Now, is your husband conscious at all?
Yes, I'm right here with him now. And he knows I'm calling you.
Well, tell him, first of all, you probably heard I had a triple bypass in December and I was very fortunate. I was only in the hospital for about 4 days. They did 3 grafts. They finished the operation in like 4.5 hours or so. I was on bypass during it. When they let me go home 4 days later, and about 2 days after that, I stopped taking the high dose pain medication that they gave me. I've been slowly recovering. It's now been about six months this week, because mine was in December. I work out in the yard. I'm doing stuff around the house. I'm moving. I'm still winded and weak. But the people who know what's best aren't a registered nurse who wants to use anecdotal information from their experience to try to affirm prayer, but the doctors that have actually been taking the best care of your husband that they can. And I'm very sorry that he had complications. But every time, I'm assuming, since he's still here and he's conscious, every time he had complications, there was a medical expert there who evaluated the problem with no appeal to a God. I don't know if they appealed to a God, but no God intervened to say, oh, here's what went wrong. We've done this dosage wrong or whatever. This is about people. And I don't get mad at people when they want to thank God that, you know, so-and-so survived. I just wish they'd also thank the people who actually did something. You are absolutely, in my view, completely justified in your anger. I would be livid if your husband's anything like me, he'd probably get up and walk out of this place if the hospital, you know, people were actually doing this. But because it's a family member, it is absolutely, I don't want to say it's completely vile, because the person who's telling you this, is a victim. They are a victim of religious indoctrination and religious thinking. And what's happened here is they care about you and they care about your husband. For some reason, because of their religious indoctrination, they're far more worried about your eternal soul than your life here on earth, because this life is like filthy rags. And as long as they have that mentality, I would not allow them in the room. I would say, if you'd like to pray, go pray. But the evidence is not on your side, despite what your anecdotal experience is. And we're not convinced. And by the way, how insulted would a God be if a couple of atheists in a time of trouble just start praying to God for help? Doesn't that play right into the no atheists in foxhole paradigm that we've all been arguing against for decades? You go ahead and get pissed. And if you need to tell her to leave, and you just continue to stay there and be supportive and loving to your husband and interact with the actual medical experts. Because when my brother and Arden were there by my side in that hotel room and for the months afterwards during recovery, that was the most important thing to me. I knew people were out there praying for me. Some of them were praying that I'd die. Some of them used my illness as an opportunity to leverage for their own. Oh, this wouldn't happen to you if you'd have been a vegan or whatever else they did. And I just set all of that bullshit aside because I was able to sit there in that hospital bed, joke with a nurse every now and then, hold hands with the woman I love, interact with my brother, who's my favorite person on the planet. And all of that got me to where I could get up and walk in a couple of days. I understand your husband's in a more difficult spot. We want the best for him, but part of the best is not allowing toxic influences into the room to poison a mindset, an atmosphere. It's not like vibes or anything, but if there's hostility between people, that's not good for you, which means it's not good for him. So kick him the fuck out.
Yeah. No, they're not here. She's in another state far away. This is what she texted me.
Yeah.
And, but
tell her she can text you in 6 months.
And if I can just add, a very similar story just to reinforce for you what's happening. So a couple of months after I deconverted and it became public that I deconverted, I was diagnosed with a very aggressive cancer. And you can, of course, imagine that the Christians in my life all came to me and said, well, this is your punishment for, you know, for deconverting. And all you need to do is come back and this cancer will go away. And so So for the exact same study that Matt just cited, I went to my Facebook page and I cited that same study that said, if I know that you are praying for me, clinically, I'm going to do worse. So please, if you care if I survive, just please, if you're praying for me, do not tell me. And that was very effective, for, at least in my community, for them to lay off. And the other thing, you know, you mentioned this nurse, sister or a relative of yours. Because I was in the hospital for so long getting my chemo and radiation, I had a lot of chance to talk to nurses and doctors. And because I was so freshly deconverted, I was really curious about all these miracle claims that I was hearing, things like that. And to a person, the medical staff would say to me, well, you know what? Our policy around here is if the people think that they are getting a miracle, we're kind of instructed to just play along with it and acknowledge it and say that it is, because that when they think that they're getting a miracle, they're going to do better, right? They think that they're in God's grace and all that kind of thing. I would just encourage, if you have a chance to talk to the medical staff, just talk to them about some of the miracles if they've really seen them, or if in fact this is just sort of the confirmation bias where we're self-selecting the positives. And, you know, the times where it didn't work out, they're just ignoring that, right? The medical staff,
yeah.
And to echo what Matt said, I just learned to thank the medical staff, because so often everything good that they do gets attributed to God. Like, can you imagine going home at the end of the day and you saved someone's life and you did some great things and all that credit went to God. So while you're there, thank your medical staff who have been trained for years and years and years to deal with this very specific section. As Matt said, ask the people who are praying for you. You can thank them if you want to, but you can just ask them not to let you know, because it's just going to add stress both to you and your husband. And go from there and know that you're not the first one. You're not going to be the last one. And I'm so sorry. It sucks so much. It was so awful. And I can't imagine living through it again. So I'm really sorry that it's you this time. But there is hope down the line.
I have a couple other things for you, Sheila. The snarky me is going to give you some tools. So first of all, this retired nurse that's telling you to pray, do they have a spouse?
Yes.
And their spouse is also similar in their religious views?
Yes, and also a nurse.
Awesome. And so are they praying for your husband?
Yes, but I don't tell my husband that.
No, that's fine. He couldn't stop them. And if they want to spend their time doing that instead of helping, at least it keeps them quiet or away from me for a while when they're praying. But Matthew chapter 18, verse 19.
Says, what was that again?
Matthew 18, 19. It's just Matthew 18, 19. We'll go with the King James. It says, again, I say unto you that if two of you shall agree on earth as touching anything that they shall ask, it shall be done for them from my Father, which is in heaven. Which means when she tells you to pray, why would your prayer be necessary if she and her spouse are already praying? Because that means there are two people who are in agreement on something, and all they have to do is pray. And the Bible says that God will make it happen. Why would they need to add your prayer? What kind of weak ass God needs more than two people to pray to him? It's unbiblical.
And the other thing is, we die. Human beings die. No amount of prayer can stop that. Every single person on this earth dies. Prayer doesn't do fuck.
Yep. I tell you, I don't envy the position you're in, Sheila, but I tell you this, the fact that he's laying there conscious next to you after the surgery and the complications is a testament to the millennia of scientific progress and discovery. and the abilities of the physicians and the physicians that came before them. I just saw a picture of a doctor who did a 27-hour heart operation, I think, in the 80s, and then sat there overnight with the patient. We have come so far. And somebody, no matter what happens to your husband, when he walks out of there, somebody's going to claim it's because they prayed to God. And I wouldn't give them the satisfaction of thinking that I joined them in that prayer. I'd rather pit science against God every day, because science is going to win every time.
I agree. And every time they tell me that to have faith in God, I say we have faith in our doctors, physicians, and all the health professionals. We have faith in science, and we believe in them. And I thank every single medical professional that comes in this room, awesome. Every single one. And I've gotten on the phone and I've called in to thank them, because that's what it's all about. There's no fucking magical God in the sky. And I'm sorry. I just got so angry and I felt so down, and just listening to you guys has brought me up, and I needed that.
Good.
And I appreciate it.
Go give that man a good squeeze on the hand. Let him know that we're all that none of us here are praying for him, all of us can't wait until he walks out of the hospital to tell his story of not only an amazing scientific procedure, but the bullshit that the religious heads threw at him throughout it. I can't wait to hear. Have him call in.
Fuck yeah, I sure will. Thank you guys so much. Have a great night.
Thanks, Sheila.
All right.
Oh, man.
That sucks.
It's all of this stuff, you know, and it hits close to home. And of course, one of our co-hosts, Dave Warnock, is, you know, essentially dying of ALS. And, you know, there's a lot of difficulties in life. And what religions often do, and I will credit them with this only slightly, is that religions are successful at providing people comfort in times of difficulty. Problem is that I think what it's providing is false comfort.
Right.
It's like saying, oh, don't worry about it. Everything's going to be fine. God's got you, or everything's going to happen according to God's plan. And so if someone survives, it's because people prayed. If someone dies, it's because God said your time is up. This is a win-win scenario for a God without ever demonstrating that a God exists or has done anything.
And of course, religions thrive where there's the most suffering, which is one of the reasons why it's not doing so well in developed worlds, when people don't need as much comfort, and isn't it when we're looking after ourselves largely, we don't need it as much. And it makes me really sad when suffering is preyed upon like that. That's very disgusting. Please don't do that.
So we've got, here's the problem, which we only have 5 minutes left in the show. We got a couple of theist callers, but there was one atheist caller that I wanted to take from China. Mercy, thanks so much for your patience. Let's try and hit this really quickly. You were wondering what my position was on death with dignity and people being granted a clearance to end their life, right?
Yeah. I think I may have misunderstood your stance. I just really have a question about how you feel about assisted suicide and who you feel should be able to just die freely. Should it just be people with terminal illnesses? Could it be somebody who's had a fucked up life from the time that they were brought on this earth? Could it be somebody who's just having a bad day and just know that they won't have a good life for the rest of their lives? Like, how do you determine who is eligible for assisted suicide? And if people choose to die with assistance, how do you determine if it was something that was dignified or if they died with dignity?
Yeah, one of the nice things is that I'm not in a position where I get to make this decision for other people. My position is really simple. Mm-hmm. I am in favor of individual sovereignty, individual autonomy, and death with dignity. I think we as a society have a duty to make sure that people aren't running around killing themselves willy-nilly, like, you know, and I don't mean to pick on anybody because of their age or anything else. This is just kind of stereotypical. A 16-year-old who feels the world's coming to an end because the person that they're attracted to isn't attracted to them, and they think this is going to be, you know, subsume the rest of their life. I think we have a duty to prevent that person from taking a rash, non-reversible action, at least in the short term. But I'm not the one who gets to decide any of this. My view of death with dignity and assisted suicide, which I am in favor of, should actually be done under the guidance of medical ethicists, not me, not Paul, not somebody else. The people who, you know, in the same way that Paul and I shouldn't be deciding the fate of the guy who got arrested for murdering someone last night on our own. We can participate in a jury process, and that process determines the dispensation of that person's punishment. I think something similar. I think there should be a medical review board, and that review board would not just deal with physical illness and but also mental illness as well. Anything where the medical ethicists, the experts, are to say, yes, this is a Yes, this is a reasonable opportunity, a reasonable conclusion, because it's undeniable to me that there are people whose quality of life is so awful that ending their life is preferable to continuing. This seems to me to be an incredibly obvious thing. And if I'm ever in that position, I would want to be able to end my life. We talk about what rights someone have. If I wanted to end my life, it's not like I have a right to do so, or my right is protected, or like they're going to arrest me if I fail or whatever. It's not like I violated a law. This is about compassion towards other human being, to say there are some people who want to commit suicide and end their existence, and they actually have good reasons for it, that their continued existence is more suffering than it is persisting, or it's more about surviving and not thriving. There are also people who would want to end their life who are just in a terrible position temporarily. And if we were to provide them a comfort and protection to move forward, we know statistically it is unlikely that they would not regret that attempt and stuff, because we know there's people who attempt this thing. I'm not the one who gets to decide for anybody. That's what the medical ethicists are for, and the experts looking at mental health issues and stuff. Paul Jade, I don't know what your position is, and I just rambled.
Well, the only, I always bring to it, so I mentioned it a couple times here that I had a cancer diagnosis. And at one point, they had warned me that I may only have 4 weeks to live. And at that point, I was very scared. And of course, I saw the other people who were in the same condition that I was in the hospital. And all the thought I always just had was, I'm much more afraid of being forced to be alive than dying, even though I was, even though I was an atheist and I no longer thought in the afterlife. And I feel so greatly for the people who would prefer to not live, but can't do something on their own. And so that's of course the situation we're looking at here. And anyone who wants to deny them any avenue of that kind of relief is just monstrous. I guess that's all I have to say.
Yeah, I think for me, this issue is easier than war. We're going to try and take one more call here in just a second. So John, hang on. For me, this call's almost easier than war. I'm not a pacifist. I am in favor of defending myself and others. I would prefer that it never get to violence. In my entire life, I've struck exactly one person, and that was in a like seventh grade, I'm going to fight you behind the magic yeah. market after school type thing. And mostly I was afraid of punching them. So I just put them in a headlock and kind of lightly popped them on the head because I was a little bigger. So I've never actually done damage to anybody like that. And I was in the military for 8 years, a little over 8 years, and served during the Gulf War and other things. I'm not pro-war. I'm not looking for it. But when we're going to take action and when we're going to involve ourselves in a military conflict, that's not a decision that just like a couple people run off and make, or the individual soldiers run off and make. That's not the way any of this works. I think we could do at least that good with dealing with people who want to die, that we can review it and recognize that not everybody who wants, somebody who wants to die, it may be temporary, it may be viewed as frivolous, although it's not frivolous to them at the time. Recognizing the complications around this, we have the ability to help people. And I find it embarrassing. This is my easiest position on death with dignity. I find it embarrassing and repugnant that I can go take my cat to the vet to have them put down in order to ease their suffering. But if a person I loved was in a similar situation, I would not have that ability. Why are we kinder to our pets than to our parents? We have one last call. We're going to go slightly over here with this. John in Texas wants to talk about the laws of reality in a King James Bible. So welcome, John.
Hey, how's everybody doing today?
Good. Are we going with the 1611 King James or a different version?
Yes, the 1611 King James Version Bible.
I got it ready. Where are we going? What are we doing?
What I want to talk about, I want to take my time, make sure I get this right. I want to talk about
I'm going to ask you to not take too much time because we've already run over time, but go ahead.
Okay. God, I want to talk about God's laws of reality. And what I mean when I say God's laws of reality, I mean the world that God says that he created, the things that are in the world, and the things that we can do and the things that we can't. For example, one of God's laws of reality is that man, he says that man is appointed once to die, meaning that you are born and then you die. And so far, that hasn't changed. Another law of reality is he says he only created life on Earth, even though scientists believe that there's alien life, but the Bible disagrees with that. Yeah. And he also says that a man.
We need to reference citation on that last one.
He says man will never live what?
And the last law I want to talk about is that man will never live on another planet, even though, see, in a lot of the laws that I'm saying, is it goes against what science teaches.
So here we are. So I want to do this. I am aware that the Bible says it's appointed unto a man once to die. However, we have people who have died and been recovered and died again and been recovered and died again and been recovered. Now, I would argue that maybe they're not completely dead, but if they hadn't been resuscitated, they would have been dead. So, okay, you get to claim, I guess, that God created medicine so that someone can be essentially dead and then revive. Okay. But let's set that one aside. Hang on, I'm still talking. Let's set that one aside, because the notion that man is appointed once to die, first of all, you have no evidence that God said anything. You have no evidence that God said any of this, and it doesn't matter whether or not God said it. This notion about death is pretty much straightforward. It's the way entropy and things work in the universe. But you say that the Bible says God only created life on Earth and that man will never live on another planet. What verses does that happen in?
In the book of Genesis, God records and he says everything that he created, from the animals to the trees to the fish to the grass to even male and female, he records everything that he created. And never did he say he created life on another planet anywhere else.
No. Here's the problem. Hang on. The fact that,
so we're
just going to talk about this in the terms that you sue. So you're saying that God says in the Bible, he created all these things and he listed them. And you're saying that the fact that God did not say, I also created things elsewhere, is equivalent to saying I did not create things elsewhere?
He wouldn't leave us in the dark about anything.
No. I asked a question. Are you suggesting that because it says God created life here and does not say that God created life elsewhere, that therefore it is impossible that God created life elsewhere?
Yes.
That is a logical fallacy that is simply not true. If I list the 10 things that I did this week at my house, that doesn't mean I didn't do other things elsewhere. You have an incredibly flawed argument on that. Where does it say man will never live on another planet?
Well, the point that I'm making is
no. I asked a question.
I asked
a question.
There's more to it.
Now I'm gonna mute you and you're gonna listen because we're already over time for the show. I want to know what verse it says where man will never live on another planet, and also does that count the moon?
In the scriptures, he tells you that man will live on Earth only and be judged from the Earth. There will be no, you won't live on Earth. God never said you will live on another planet. You're going to be judged on
Earth. Where does it say man will only live on Earth?
I'm telling you that man will only live on Earth.
I'm saying, where in the Bible does it say that?
Can you tell me where man is living on another planet?
I'm sorry. Are you just going to go straight to a logical fallacy because I called you out for some bullshit that you can't prove? Where in the Bible does it say that man will not live on another planet?
I'm telling you, throughout the Bible,
there's no such thing as throughout the fucking Bible, you dishonest person. Where in the Bible, if you're going to say the Bible says man won't live on another planet, chapter and verse right now.
Okay, there is no verse, but I'm telling you this.
So you're a liar.
That's what I'm saying.
You're a liar for God. Goodbye.
Wow. I there's no verses where about men living in America.
Yeah.
And nowhere in Genesis 1 does it say that God created angels. And I'm sure he believes in angels. So I don't know. I don't know what to do.
Yeah. It's amazing. So first of all, there's a logical fallacy here that this notion that if God didn't say he did something, then he didn't do it. And you just, you know, perfectly rebutted that because, oh, didn't say this. Ah, but you believe it. This is the thing. It's worse than we think because people are like, oh, Matt's just terrible. He doesn't let the people speak. He doesn't let them make their bullshit. pull the other one. You liars, you fucking liars, for your disgusting book, for your disgusting, immoral, sexist, racist, violent fucking book that inspires people to prey on people in times of need and tell them that they're responsible if they didn't reach out to God. And then you come in with bullshit about, oh, God didn't say he created things on another planet, so he must not have. Well, you know what? As far as I'm concerned, John, God hasn't said anything. I granted you that we'll go with what the Bible says, and we'll go with the Bible being the word of God, and we'll go with you point to the Bible and tell me what the Bible says. And for the sake of argument, I'll just go with it. And you couldn't even do that because you guys make up whatever shit you want. The Bible, as Don Baker used to say, is the great book of multiple choice. You can make it say whatever you want as long as you allow for interpretation. And as soon as we find out more things about the world, you can go back and interpret scripture so that you think in a non-canonical book like Enoch that he's talking about supermassive black holes. You can just claim with the Christian, prove with the scientist. Get the fuck out with that stuff. It's embarrassingly bad. And when I ask a simple question, you want to tell me, hey, the Bible says this? Where does the Bible say that? Well, it says it all throughout. No, it doesn't. No, it absolutely doesn't. You people don't know your own book. You don't know the history of that book. You don't know what's going on. I had somebody else. I've been scrounging through TikTok.
And in that's a mistake. All right.
I'm looking for live apologists on TikTok that I can interact with. Because if I find one that's actually capable of having a conversation, I want to get them to call in.
Yeah, yeah.
And so instead, what I get are people who literally understand the Bible in their version in English. And when I point out what the actual Hebrew or Greek says or Arabic says and why they should get a wonderful tool like this e-sword that I have, because I don't know all this stuff off the top of my head. They're just like, well, no, it was revealed to me. I've been banned from so many live Christian TikToks. It's pathetic. And most of them have banned me because I've asked, how can you demonstrate the truth of what you claim?
And that was a problem. I had a believer when I was a believer. I just assumed that the pastors and stuff, you know, had done all the checking. And then eventually I needed to go do the checking myself. And I just wish that's what the TikTok Christians would do, is check yourself before you embarrass yourself by repeating something you heard.
Yeah. Now, I did have a preacher give a sermon once about whether or not there was life on another planet. And his answer was basically, I don't know. But if there is, they didn't sin because,
That's the Ken Ham. That's the Ken Ham answer. Yeah. My mom always thought there's a verse where it says, Jesus says there are sheep in a pen that none of you know about. And my mom always said, well, that must be the aliens.
And cool. At least your mom, I can appreciate this. Maybe I can appreciate if you go back through the show today, the first caller, I was happy to go until they said it describes it exactly. No, it doesn't. It doesn't even describe it vaguely. The time at which we interrupt with stuff is important for clarity. I don't want to keep harping on this because the callers aren't actually here anymore, but we've run over time. And I really was hoping that when somebody calls in to talk about what the King James Bible says, that they might actually know what the King James Bible says and that they'd have picked something out where they had a verse prepared. At least the guy who was citing Enoch knew the three verses that he wanted to reference.
Right. Yeah.
But if you don't know your book, you know, can we put up the merchandise thing again? I know the crew's ready to go, but this is how we're going to do this. That t-shirt in the middle where it says, Theist, you need to bring your A game. That is the most clear instruction you're going to get. If you show up not knowing what your book says and pretend like you do, you're going to get trounced. If you show up pretending you know what atheists think and believe and then demonstrate that you don't, you're going to get trounced. I know you won't believe this, probably won't believe this about me. Maybe you'll believe it about Paul. Neither one of us show up here this week or any other week looking to embarrass Christians or trounce them. Both of us would love to know what the truth is. And if you have it, we'd like to know it. And if we have it, we'd like to help you understand it. It gets incredibly frustrating from time to time. And I'm more likely to lose my patience after 17 years of doing this than Paul is. But the thing is, none of us are asking for anything special. We're not asking for, you better come with a fire in the sky message that everybody can read in their language sort of thing and proof of God. Just make an actual valid and sound argument backed by evidence, just like you would for anything else. When you say, how do we know that evolution by means of natural selection happened? Well, that's a theory. It is a model based on this, this, and this. And here are the bits of evidence that point to it. How do we know that vaccines don't, in fact, cause autism? Here's the studies that show this thing. How do we know that cooperation is better than conflict? We know that from the evidence and from game theory. How do we know that prayer does not work, that intercessory prayer fails and in some cases can do harm if the person knows they're being prayed about it. I know that, not because of anything any atheist said, but because a Christian organization, the Templeton Foundation, did this research because that organization desperately wants to prove that there's a God. And so they spend millions of dollars funding research in the hopes that someday science will confirm the likelihood or probability of a God. And yet it doesn't happen. And while some people think, well, maybe they will someday, I think they won't ever. And the reason is, if there was a God who wanted a demonstrable bit of evidence for its existence, and an organization like the Templeton Foundation was doing a test on intercessory prayer, God would know it, and God would reveal himself through that study the first time, the second time, the third time, the fourth time. But clearly, he either doesn't exist or doesn't want us to know he exists. Either way, not my fucking problem. And if you can't come with your A game, we'll move on to the next caller. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Thank you to our crew who did work. Thank you so much to Paul. I love doing the shows with you. I look forward to doing it again later.
Sounds good.
And please take care of yourself. And yes, there will be conversations. Stay tuned for this week's nonprofits or the next week's nonprofits where they'll be talking about the school shooting and things. But thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
What will it take for you to start opening your eyes, to stop questioning the bullshit everyone around you buys? You think it's any of your business what goes on between my thighs? I wonder when we'll be rid of your life.
It's time to get sex. So watch Secular Sexuality live Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central. Visit tiny.cc/YTSS and call into the show at 512-991-9242 or connect to the show online at tiny.cc/callsex.